Andrei Lenkov is a professor of Korean studies at Gunmin University in Seoul, and he joins us now from Washington, where he is on a visit. So when President Trump met with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore last month, June 12th, part of me could not help but just be hopeful. I mean, here were two leaders who only weeks before were tweeting nuclear threats at each other, and now they're actually shaking hands. That was just 6 weeks ago. What do you point to for signs of hope today?
Well, frankly, I've never had much hope. I had no hope during the Singapore summit, and I don't have much hope now. First of all, neither North Korea nor United States are going to start a war. Well, there used to be a reasonably high risk of a unilateral U.S. military operation last year, but not much more. And, however, North Korea has no intention to surrender its nuclear weapons. Officially, the major goal of negotiations between the United States and North Korea is to achieve the denuclearization of North Korea. But there is one problem. North Korean government, North Korean elite, not only Kim Jong-un, but many, many thousands of people around him, everybody who matters in North Korea, believes that if their country surrenders nuclear weapons, it will go away of Iraq and Libya. And they don't want it. They see it as a suicide, and they have not the slightest intention to do it.
Even with President Trump shaking hands with Kim Jong-un, I mean, that never really happened with Iraq and with Libya. I mean,
So what is magical about shaking hands with the United States president? Does he have some kind of supernatural power in his hands? Well, maybe. Well, in the past, in medieval eras, people believed something like that about kings.
But, I mean, it's not not a supernatural power, but, I mean, it is symbolic, don't you agree?
Well, symbolism is great, but it's cheap and meaningless. North Korea is run by hard-nosed realists, people who don't care about symbols. They care about money, power, and guns.
What about the story that's come out in recent days about the North Koreans beginning to dismantle a key missile facility? How big of a step is that?
It's not a key missile facility. It's one of many missile facilities. What's happened? Last year, it looked like that U.S. administration, Trump administration, was ready to strike North Korea if they don't make any concessions. At the same time, American diplomats succeeded in creating a united front with China. So China joined an unprecedented, tough sanctions regime. Essentially, North Korea was banned from conducting any foreign trade starting from early this year. So economic crisis and probability of American military attack. Is it nice? Definitely not. North Koreans decided to start making concessions, as little as possible. As few as possible, but they decided to give up something, to surrender something. There were some unilateral concessions. All are reversible, and it's going to continue. Meanwhile, Trump administration started a trade war with China. United front on the North Korean issues between U.S. and China collapsed. China is not that serious about sanctions anymore. North Korea is quietly trading with China. They get a bit of money, and it's highly unlikely that U.S. military threat should be taken seriously in the near future, but they have to play safe. So what we are going to see, typical North Korean tactics, they will work hard to win time. There will be some concessions, like this test site. It's not expensive. It can easily be rebuilt, but they will make a wonderful show of it. Then there will be returns of the remains of the U.S. soldiers killed during the Korean War. So they will make some concessions to keep what is now called good optics and win time. Their task is simple: outweigh Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of establish as a truism that the U.S. is not going to start a war and invade North Korea, nor is North Korea going to give up its nuclear weapons.
Yes.
I understand the second part of that. How come you're so certain that the U.S. won't start some unilateral invasion?
I am less certain under President Trump, and this is exactly the reason why all these talks between North Korea and United States are taking place, because North Korean leaders are not certain either. In the past, situation was very simple. The capital of South Korea, the city of Seoul, is located within the shooting range of the North Korean heavy artillery. It was assumed that if the United States, an ally of South Korea, hits North Korea, the North Koreans will hit back U.S. military installations in South Korea and maybe the city of Seoul. So, in a sense, 25 million people who live in Seoul and its vicinity are hostages, and for decades it was an assumption that no U.S. president would ever risk using our armed force against North Korea, because North Koreans will probably retaliate by hitting Seoul, and it will lead to massive casualties, and also will seriously undermine alliance between United States and Republic of Korea. However, rightly or wrongly, many people believe that President Trump is different, that he doesn't care that much about allies, and if he believes that something is necessary for the national interest of the United States alone, he is willing to act unilaterally. And last year, we heard a lot of talks about a possible military actions if North Koreans continue building up their nuclear and missile program. So they stop program for a while. They are talking about possible concessions, which are going to be minimal, and it's happening exactly because there are seemingly some risks of the U.S. military action because of Donald Trump, President Trump's view of the outside world.
If the U.S. and China are no longer a united front, does that raise or decrease the risk of some hot war?
I think it's difficult to say. I would say decrease, but I'm not so sure, because there is a problem. So far, we are going to see a stage of slow-motion negotiations, broken deadlines, minor concessions, another rounds of negotiations. But what if Donald Trump, President Trump, decides that North Koreans are sort of, double crossing him, that they are cheating of him? It's quite possible that he will decide to go back to what was officially called maximum pressure policy last year, and which is sometimes called fire and fury policy because one of President Trump's tweets. So if it happens and there is a probability of a unilateral action, and I'm not sure, maybe Chinese support will provoke North Korea into doing something excessively bold and provocative, and it will provoke United States in action. So I'm not so sure whether it's good or bad. It's good for the average North Korean. Their living standards are not going to decline anytime soon now. But for the general situation, I'm not so sure.
Andrei Lenkov, you're in Washington right now. What kind of information or what kind of sense are you getting there in the U.S. Capitol from what's going on in North Korea?
Well, I would say that official line is that we are in the beginning of negotiation process and the goal is denuclearization. More and more professional career watchers and security specialists realize that denuclearization is not an achievable goal. I spent roughly the last 15 years saying so. I used to be in a small minority. Now it's pretty much majority. People who believe that denuclearization is not achievable as long as the Kim family is in control. But it seems that major hope realistically is, of course, arms reduction. And indeed, North Koreans still feel insecure. They still feel uncomfortable. They are willing to make some concessions. We should not overestimate these concessions, but the U.S. diplomacy should aim at maximizing this concession. And North Korean diplomacy will definitely aim at minimizing concessions. Usual diplomatic activity. And many people in Washington hope that using these opportunities, many opportunities were wasted the last few months, but some opportunities still exist. And many people in Washington believe that using these opportunities, it will be possible to get some concessions, some meaningful reduction of the North Korean nuclear and missile threat. Non-denuclearization, I would say almost nobody among the Korean specialists believe in that denuclearization is possible. But arms reduction, it's still probably achievable, and let's hope that something will happen. Just let's not have exaggerated hopes, exaggerated expectations. Because in Singapore we had this, euphoria, all this completely unfounded, comically exaggerated stories about age of prosperity, cooperation, denuclearization, blah, blah, blah. It was not going to happen. Let's not fool ourselves. But some improvement is still possible.
Yeah, I mean, how do you fold into your analysis the reports that, in private, Donald Trump is frustrated by the lack of progress on the situation with North Korea?
Because it's quite possible that President Trump sincerely believed that denuclearization was possible. Some people, basically even in security establishment, as long as they have never, ever dealt with the issue, still believe it. So definitely President Trump probably hoped that he would have a deal, he would shake hands. You ask about shaking hands, do you?
Yeah.
So he also believed that symbolism will be powerful and North Koreans will be overwhelmed by the might and greatness of the United States and they will trust him. And of course, North Koreans don't trust him. They trust nobody but themselves. And they will make serious concessions. And he sees that time is going on and concessions are very small, which was totally predictable. Totally predictable. And he feels frustrated because probably he hoped for a miracle. And miracle is not delivered. But miracles don't happen.
You're Russian. You live in South Korea and you focus your research on North Korea. Early on in the history of North Korea, after and even during the Korean War, the Soviet Union was crucial in assisting the North develop. Mm-hmm. The Soviets had basically an intel pipeline in and out of Pyongyang. In 2018, does that allow you today any special insight into what's going on there?
Only basic understanding of the system, which was initially quite similar with the political system of the Soviet Union under Stalin, but then Soviet Union and North Korea evolved in essentially the opposite direction. North Korea first became more Stalinist than Stalin's Russia, and then the system disintegrated in the 1990s, and it's now a sort of, it's in some regards similar to China of the early period of reforms, because North Korea is reforming and quite successfully. And the idea of North Korea as a starving country is outdated. Economy is growing quite well because it's private now. It's essentially a capitalist economy now. Soviet Union and North Korea parted ways decades ago, but there are some similarities in the ideology, in the political structure, so it helps. Plus, as long as I'm doing research on history, many key available documents are still in Russian.
Well, let me ask you this, which is kind of tied into what you were just talking about, the human rights situation in North Korea. About a week ago, a report came out, the Global Slavery Index, and it found that 2.6 million people live under slavery conditions in North Korea. How surprising is that to you, and what are the chances of this situation changing as a result of Trump's diplomacy?
It depends on how you define slavery. I think that a significant part of these people don't see themselves as slaves and see their jobs as reasonably well paid and natural because they have lived in such situation for their entire life. And most of them, because country is completely isolated from the outside world, are not aware that life can be different. Having said that, talking about the impact of diplomacy on the human rights situation, I don't see how it's going to have any impact. Because North Korean government, they are reforming economy, and their goal is to improve material standards of life for the majority of population. And they're doing it quite well. It's still a very poor country, but the economy is growing, life is getting better. Not only in Pyongyang, not only for elite, for everybody. But at the same time, they believe that they have to remain highly repressive. They believe that if they allow, say, free exchange of information with the outside world, if they let their own people to learn how people in other countries live. They are afraid that their people will start asking dangerous questions, and they don't want it. So they want to keep country isolated, and they want to enforce very rigid, very repressive order. And it's not going to change, because people who matter, once again, not only Kim, but maybe 250,000, 500,000, 1,000,000 people in the country, they believe that they have to remain repressive, they have to remain tough on their own population to keep country stable and under control. And nothing is going to change this assumption, especially any kind of diplomacy.
You know, years ago, John Bolton, who is now the national security advisor to President Trump, described North Korea as a hellish nightmare. Is that still the case? Would you agree with him now or then?
There were periods in North Korean history when it was a fairly good description. But now I would not agree. It's a nightmare which is getting less and less hellish and less nightmarish. As I have said, economy is growing. Nobody is starving. A lot of people are malnourished, but nobody is starving. At least, you know, poor people can eat corn gruel every day. Well, richer people can have some protein. There are many power-assisted bikes and a lot of construction. Life is getting better. And even in terms of political repression, yes, country is extremely brutal. But until, say, 10 years ago, if somebody committed a political crime, even very minor crime, not a joke about leader, it's a big crime to make a joke about the great leader, a small crime, something secretly listening to foreign broadcast, say, until slightly more than 10, 19, 15 years ago, roughly, the entire family would be, all people who shared household registration with a criminal would be shipped to a prison camp. Entire family, just because you were registered on the same address as a political criminal.
And today?
Not the case anymore. In exceptional cases, normally families are left alone. And even I think that in most cases, if you are listening to, say, foreign broadcast, if you are caught, it's a problem. But first of all, you can pay a bribe to a secret police officer. And secret police officer is corrupt, and it's good because they used to be incorrupt and it was bad. Now you can buy your way out of prison. 20 years ago, it was impossible. You can pay a bribe. And in most cases, they probably just turn a blind eye to minor illegalities of political nature. And when it comes to daily life, well, as long as you are not engaged in violent crime, they don't care whether you follow outdated instructions from the Stalinist era, because essentially country's economy is driven by market economy, by capitalist economy.
That's fantastic. For my own personal curiosity, do you remember the hack of the Sony Entertainment
yes.
hack?
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of fingers were pointing to North Korea after the movie The Interview, as a kind of act of revenge. Was North Korea able to do that on their own? Did they need help from Russia?
Oh, I don't think they would ever get help from Russia. And from China, as a matter of fact, too. Of course, they did it on their own, and they have very good hacking capabilities. They are hacking everybody. Basically, my computer is attacked by them pretty much maybe once every 2 months or so. And it's not only me, all North Korea specialists have this problem. They keep trying to get into our computer using quite sophisticated methods. They're very active hackers, based usually outside the country, China, Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Indonesia, all places. Small groups of North Korean hackers are operating. They're doing quite well. They're highly professional.
Andrei Lankov is a professor of Korean studies at Gumin University in Seoul. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.